Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. My name is Tom Waller. I'm chair of the club's Business and Leadership Forum and your host for today's program, which is entitled Lead or Fail, Why Leadership Style is Critical in Tough Times. We invite our audience to visit us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org to learn about the many fine programs, events, which are held here at the club. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker. Dr. Sheila Murray Bethel is the best-selling author of this recently published book, A New Breed of Leader, Eight Qualities That Matter Most in the Real World, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. She has worked on projects with four U.S. presidents and has served on several faculties of U.S. universities. She is currently on the board of advisors of the newly formed Amsted University in Malaysia. Her Ph.D. is in communications. Sheila is a globally acknowledged expert on leadership and change. She has spoken to over 2 million people in 17 nations. Please join me in welcoming Sheila Murray Bethel.
Is this the one that is working? It is indeed working. Great, it's working now. Glad to see all of you. I am by nature, I just cannot help not having a handout. That's what I do for a living. So does anybody not have this little handout? Did anybody miss one? Oh, well, here we go, all right. All right, please do. She needs two, Bill. Great. My husband, Bill. We say hello to my husband, Bill, yes? My partner in life and business. I'm delighted to be here. I am a hopefully active member with the Commonwealth Club, and when have spoken here several times before over the years on leadership, depending on what was going on in our lives and what we were doing. And so when the new book came out, we talked about with them that maybe we could come and do another presentation. And I said, of course, it's my club. So I would love to be here. So I'm glad to see all of you here. I always find it interesting, within the Commonwealth Club, we have such a diverse group and so many people that do so many different things. So it's always interesting to me to find out and talk with people of why they came and what might be of interest to them. Because the title that when Tom and I were talking, he said, well, we need a title that's kind of provocative. And I said, I got one for you. And he said, okay, what? And I said, it's called Lead or Fail. He said, that works. And when I talk about that, it is because we are living in absolutely, it's not a surprise to you, extraordinary times in our business lives, in our personal lives, in our community lives, in this country, around the world. These are extraordinary times. And when these kinds of situations come up, which don't happen very often in the history of human beings, when so many problems coalesce at one time, that we must have leaders, not just managers. Now, everybody needs to be a good manager. I mean, we know we can't function without good management. But leadership is a quantum leap to go from management to leadership. The critical difference is, and if you are note takers, which I encourage you to do, the other side of that handout is blank in case you want to write some notes. On purpose, I left it blank. So we are living, and I wrote about it throughout the book, about questions. We are living in the age of questions. There are no simple answers because there are no simple problems. And anybody that says that there are simple answers to any of the issues we're facing, they either have been living in a cave somewhere or on the moon or don't realize or just not aware of how difficult and complex the issues are that we're dealing with. So whether you are here because you have a small business, whether you work for someone, whether you are in a leadership position, want to do something in a place of faith-based, if you want to do something in your community, or if you're just interested in learning what leaders do so you can be a better follower, I am for that. Because does everybody want to be a leader? No. Does everybody have to be a leader? No. Can everybody be a leader? No. But can everybody be an informed follower? Absolutely. And if we have more informed followers, the better we can do of doing our part to help with the changes that we need to make to solve the issues that we're doing. So when I look at the things that I wanted to talk about, and someone said to me on the phone today, in fact, well, could you come and give your standard leadership presentation? I said, I'm sorry, there is no such a thing. It depends on who I'm talking to and who the group is. And tomorrow night I'm doing a presentation for a group of women in the North Bay for the Women in Business, the business journal for the winners of the Women in Business. Well, that's going to be kind of different because, no offense, gentlemen, but when it's all women, I can use some really funny stuff that you don't use in always general mix. It's not that it's off color. It's just that it's kind of like the ladies get it, and sometimes the men don't. So my audiences are usually mixed, but each group is different. So I made some notes because I wanted to be sure that we fulfilled your expectations for coming. Why is your style of leadership in this day and age important, and what difference does it make, and how can you take your leadership style, whether you're a beginning leader, intermediate, or experienced, and adjust it and make it work for you in the situation where you are helping other people to go through the changes that we have been going through. And by the way, we are going through major changes, which I don't have to tell anybody. How many have had change in, say, their business life in the last 6 months? Or how about life? Anybody had some change? Yes? Living on this planet, have you had some change? Yes. How about the last 2 months? 2 weeks? 20 minutes? Have you checked? Maybe things are a little different. And since I love humor, because by the way, here's the first clue for you. If you can't have a sense of humor in this day and age as a leader, you are dead in the water. You've got to be able to have a sense of humor. And I found this in a magazine a few years ago. I thought it was so interesting. Talks about the latest census. Now, we have a new one coming up next year, so I guess I have to find a new story after next year. But I love that it says, you can dig out all sorts of interesting tidbits if you really look into the latest national census. For example, the latest census counted 1 million more women than men who are separated from their spouses. And it says that's either a mistake or there are about 1 million men who haven't yet noticed that their wives have left. Now, I haven't a clue of what that means about the men or the women. But I know that we've gone through a lot of change, and that's the key. What changes do you need to make personally to lead better, to help people through the changes that we're going through across the rickety bridge from today into the future? Because it can get pretty scary going through the kind of changes. I know there's one lady here tonight that her company may be moving, and she's not sure whether she's going to have a job, and will she have to work at home? Is she going to be out of a job? That's pretty scary stuff, not knowing what are we going to be doing next week, next month, next year. That is very disconcerting to we human beings because we don't like things to change that much. But it is changing, and those who can understand the basic leadership principles are the ones that are going to make the difference in the future that we're creating for ourselves, our children, and our grandchildren. And when I looked at what has changed and why did I write a new book as opposed to my last one, and I wrote A New Breed of Leader for this reason. I travel all over the world working in every possible industry and function of organizations that you can even think of. I mean, you name it, I've worked with them. And around the world, we are all going through the same thing. We must take the best leadership principles of the past, the good standard ones that have always held us in good stead, and update them and view them through a new prism so that we can then find the new answers to the issues that we are facing today. And as I go through it, I will give you some examples of what is old, how we need to look at it new, and how you put it to work for you so your leadership style is keeping up with what's going on. And that's very critical so that you can be an effective leader. And so then to begin with, this is an era of questions, not answers. There are very few answers, single answers, do this, do that to make it work. It is usually a commonality of concerns come together with a commonality of intelligence and opportunity put together. And for each of us, we have to be able to match what we know with what's happening today and where we think we're going in the future, and we can none of us do that alone. We have to be very cooperative in our leadership style, and that is one of the keys. So let's look at that little handout I gave you, because I have some little ideas for you and some stories to tell you. And I always do one thing, particularly since this new book came out. I will give you as many leadership challenge questions as we have time for to leave time for the questions and answers, because I don't have all the answers and you don't have all the answers. But if we as individuals and as a group can come up with good questions, that's the value. One good question is better than 1,000 answers, because you then can take that question and apply your situation, your skills, and your talent to finding the answer that works for you. So good questions are the key. The best leaders we have are those who have the courage to ask the tough questions that nobody else wants to ask, because it's not good, it's not fun, it's not easy. So looking at the first one then, competence. What is different about competence? Why do I say competence matters? And how is that different than it was in the past? If I ask you, maybe somebody will even give me an answer, what is the most important leadership quality you think a leader needs? Can somebody give me an answer?
Intuitiveness.
Well, that's very smart, because that's in the first quality I have. Very good. Usually when I will say that, people will say, oh, to have a vision, to have a mission. And of course, absolutely, that's right. If you don't have a vision and you don't have a mission, you're not going anywhere as a leader. But here's why this is new. Why is competence? Why did I put it at the top? Because if you have the competence to back your vision up, you can move mountains. But if you don't have the competence, if you don't learn, if you don't grow, if you don't go after answers that handle the questions to help you move your vision forward, it remains a dream. It remains a goal, a nice goal. But you can look at all kinds of things that have gone on in the last 20 years where people had great vision, but there was no competence to back it up. In our daily lives, we can see that many times. So on that one, we want to say, what is the challenge question? We want to say, am I building my leadership competence? What am I doing to build my leadership competence? One of the kinds of competence that is happening, which is very exciting, is the cooperative leadership style that is happening. I don't know how many of you, just by a show of hands, know about Ursula Burns and Anne Mulcahy from Xerox. Yes, one lady does know. I'll tell the rest of you very quickly. At Xerox, Anne came in to take over, Anne Mulcahy, as CEO, and she started turning that company around, and it was just, it was wonderful. But it was also legendary because they had never had a female at the top of a major U.S. company as a CEO, and Ursula Burns, she appointed as her president, and they did an unprecedented thing. They said, to make this thing work, we're going to have to split the responsibility right down the middle, get our egos out of the way. They assessed their own skills. Ursula is the in-house, get-it-done, bullet-point person, and Anne is the out-front face of it all. But they were as tight a team as have ever been created, and the two of them brought Xerox into the 21st century, and they are an excellent company. And they each took their skills very collaboratively. And now what is happening in July, this month coming up, Anne is going to retire. And here's another historic thing. It's the first time in American business history that a female CEO is going to retire and turn it over to another female CEO. And on top of that, the other historic thing is Ursula is African American. So we're breaking all kinds of precedents. But the two of them understand, they understand and have understood the power of competence, of what each of their own skills were. And where they thought they weren't as strong, they went to work learning. And Xerox is a company that focuses on training their people, because the two of them understand the only way we're going to grow is if we increase that competence. So my challenge to you is, on the question is, what are you doing to build your competent skills? Because to lead today, if we're not learning, we're not leading. The minute you stop learning, you stop leading. And then the second one is accountability. It is amazing, absolutely amazing. I don't know, there's some people here in the room that are not old enough to remember. They'll remember the issue, but not the scene when the Tylenol tampering happened. And they found out about that first case in Chicago where the lady died. The CEO, Jim Burke, of Tylenol, Johnson & Johnson, came right on television that night, stood there blank-faced right into the cameras and said, we are responsible. It is our product. There was no hem-ha. There was no waiting. Bam, that night, right on the television, faced it and said, bring them all back. We'll give you credit. Do not take any Tylenol. Do not take any Tylenol. Stop. Bring it all back. And there was, and now remember, that was like 25 years ago. $8 million worth of products were returned to the stores within 3 or 4 days. And, of course, that created the new tamper-proof medicines that we now all buy every day at the grocery store. But his openness and his accountability was unprecedented. It is still being used in business schools around the world as the example of what true accountability means. Because the thing is, not just to say, oh, I'm responsible, I accept the responsibility for this, that's not enough. Words are cheap. What he did is he took action immediately. And within 1 year, they regained all of their strength, all of the money that they had lost because everybody brought it back, and they were stronger in the marketplace with their stock ratings and everything else, and everybody has used that since. There's a current example. Do you remember 2 years, maybe it's been a year and a half ago, when the medical problems coming out of Walter Reed Hospital in Washington, D.C. about our young men and women who came back from Iraq and were so badly damaged and all that scandal about how badly they were treated and all of that stuff. And the Secretary of Veterans Affairs was wishy-washy, him-hawing, trying to get out of it. And you know, well, it's not so bad. Bill Gates is Microsoft. Robert Gates came on that camera that night, said he is wrong, heads rolled, people retired, positions changed, and he was on it that day. And they started working on it. They've made great progress. That is a current example about total accountability right up front. And it's understandable why he has been brought into this administration, because one of the things that the administration talks about most is accountability. So there's an old example and a new example. So you want to say to yourself, because accountability fosters trust. That's the benefit of accountability. You feel like you can trust them. We can trust Johnson & Johnson, who makes Tylenol. We can trust Mr. Gates that he's going to do the right things for our veterans, because he proved it. He took action. So the challenge then for you is looking at your accountability. That leadership question is, how do I show my accountability within my organization, within my group? If you're a leader of 4 people within an organization, you're still the leader, so how do you show your accountability? That's the challenge. And so for you to examine that. Then we want to look at openness. Openness matters. In this day and age, let me give you 3 things we must absolutely avoid when it comes to being a good leader about being open. When you're open with your people, that means, 1, get perfection out of the way. There is no such thing as perfection except in space, in a vacuum. 2, allow people to fail in order to succeed and get that driven into your organization. One of the things that I talk about, one of the interviews that we did, and I have another one coming up for some broadcast people, was I opened my mouth on one interview and said, we have to create a new business model. Well, you know, you forget the cameras are on and the mics are on, and so you get stuck with that. So somebody said, well, now come and tell us what kind of a new business model you think we need. I said, okay, I got one for you. We have to go back to rewarding risk and failure. As a country, we've become so afraid to make a mistake and that you have to be successful. I have never known, I don't know about you, I've never known anybody, any company, any organization who is successful who didn't fail, get up, try again, fail, get up, try again, fail, and then get to success. So we have to, in this new business model that I now guess I have to describe, is we have to get back to risk-taking and not punishing when people make a mistake. That's the third thing. Open the idea of taking risk. Go ahead and take it, and don't punish people. Once you tell them, let's be open, let's try, then reward people who have the courage and the willingness to think differently, out of the box, as was a big saying in the 90s. I like that one. I brought that one forward, too, because I think that still works. So we want to be open about it. Now, one of the things that was very interesting that Google did about 2 months ago, Google sent out a worldwide, a global question out into every way that Google knows how to do, and it said, we're going to give cash prizes, this was to the general public, to the people that can come up with the best answers to some of our biggest problems. And he didn't say where, what country, what problem, or anything. Eric Schmidt, and they sent this huge thing out. They got 150,000 responses the first night after they sent it out from all over the world, and they picked 15 and they gave cash prizes to people that came up with ideas. That kind of openness to hear what anybody has to say, and they knew they were opening a can of worms, because you know, you start saying to anybody, well, what do you think the answer is? You may not always like what they say. And it was amazing, and they had some amazing thing. You can go to the Google site, and if you noodle around, you can find the answers that people came up with. So when we look at that openness, what we want to do, remember, don't reject any idea. Don't reject any idea. You know, it's not right today, maybe, but who knows, 2 weeks from now, it might be exactly the answer. And get perfection out of the way. No such thing as perfection. And then, of course, give people and encourage them to try and fail and try again. So what is the question on this one? My question is, if you are a manager, a leader in your family, in the community, in your work, is this, what is my message about openness? What example do I set to others? What message do I send by my own openness? Big example. See, I think we lead first by example. Everything we do, everything we say, sends a message, sets a tone, teaches people what to do or what not to do. They watch everything that you do. If you're a leader, they watch how you walk, how you talk. What does your desk look like? What does your car look like? I mean, you know, they watch everything. And if you pick up the mantle of leadership, you now live under the scrutiny of your followers. And here's the key. If you write it down, if you're taking notes, put it somewhere. It's so huge. It's this new business model. Leadership is earned, not claimed. It doesn't matter if you're sitting in the CEO's office. It's not for you to say you're the leader. It's for the follower to say, aha, I like where she's going. I like what she has to say. I trust him. I will follow him. He is the leader. We have gotten this business model of people pounding their chest and this celebrityism and saying, I'm the leader. That's not for you to say. It's for your followers to say, yeah, he's the leader. And what's most interesting is, just did an interview this afternoon for the Chamber of Commerce, the National Chamber of Commerce for their magazine, and I said, you know what? Some of the best leaders in your organization are quiet. They don't even have the title, and no one would say necessarily that, oh, she's the leader, he's the leader. But you watch how they act. You watch how they perform. What do they do about openness and competence and accountability? So that quietness about leadership is so powerful. So what is your example? What is the message that you're sending? So then if we look at language, there have been, in the last 100 years, a few people that have such command of the language that they have changed the way people live around the world. We can think of some from the last century, Mahatma Gandhi and Mother Teresa. Her, by her few words, but by her actions. Gandhi, by his speeches. And, of course, actions are words, too. And we can look at all the warriors during the Second World War, and we know, you know, Winston Churchill, never, 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 never give up. You don't have to say a lot, but if you say powerful things, if your language does one thing, and this is the biggest challenge for you on this one, is does your language give hope? There is never a time in history where people don't need hope. Hope about their personal lives, hope about their business, hope about their community, about the issues in which they care so deeply and are so deeply invested. And if you are a leader who could go to someone and say, thank you for being a part of this organization, I'm really glad to have you, and let me know what I can do to help you. He doesn't have to say, I'm here to give you hope today. But by the words and the actions and the way you validate someone by your words, your language, it is incredibly powerful and important. And I talked to a person on the phone the other day and was talking to their client of mine. I was doing a little consulting, and they said, well, how do I go about figuring out if my language is hope-giving? And I said, well, you can do a couple of things. One, you could take a little recording device and put it in your pocket, turn it on, go around, talk to your people, then go in private and listen to how does it sound? See, because language builds or it tears down. It encourages or it discourages. It helps or it hurts. You can hear the words very clearly. Is it based on fear or is it based on hope? Is it based on courage or cowardice? I mean, you can hear the words. And I said, now, if you don't want to do it that way because of invasion of someone else's privacy, you know, they might be responding to you and wouldn't want you to record it, I said, then go find two or three trusted colleagues and have them take notes on what they hear you say to your people over the next week or two and tell them, no holds barred. Write down what I say. Tell me what you think of it. Because the only way we can really look at our language is to say to ourselves, did I just give someone some hope about what's going on? And that can be in training when you're working with someone to help them do a job better. It's how you say it. Sometimes I'll do a whole seminar just on communication skills, and I will say for a leader, how do you start the conversation? How do you start it? What kind of words do you use? Do you say, that was a really good try. I appreciate you trying so hard, even though you failed. You see, I mean, you can start the conversation out by, boy, you really messed up. We got to fix this. Now, who's going to love that? How many would love that? Nobody wants to raise their hand. But if somebody came to you and said, you know, that was a great try. I really appreciate it. Let's see what we can do to fix it or help you get on the right track. That is a hopeful, hope-giving way of communicating to people. So it's important that you read and study and learn about language skills. Not just speaking, but writing. I receive some of the most horrible emails. What people put in emails, my gosh, I can't even believe it. And I think, and this is the leader? I wonder how the people feel when they get emails like that. Not a hello, not a dear, or not a good morning. No greeting at all. We are losing our language skills. When you talk to someone, if you go up to someone that you're just meeting, do you usually say, what's your name? Mike, do you usually say, hi, Mike, I'm glad to see you. Good morning, nice to see you, Mike, and then we have a conversation. Do you get right in someone's face and lay the issue on them without saying good morning, not using their name? I don't think so. We need to have a really hard look at what we're doing with language in communication, emails, all kinds of ways. Now, I have to tell you, I was a really skeptical person about Twitter. Somebody says, oh, you got to get Twitter so people can follow you. I said, I don't want people following me. I don't care I don't want them to know when I go to the grocery store, when I'm on an airplane, when I check in a hotel. Who cares what you're doing? And I think this is pretty egotistical technology. You think you're so important that people want to know everything you're doing and follow you? I mean, I understand social networks. I have fun with mine, too. Well, I have changed my mind about Twitter because of what's going on in Iran. Now we have taken a short thing that really is kind of destroying communications because you can have only, what, 145 characters? Doesn't anybody Twitter? I think it is, something like that. Is it, what, 140? Okay, thank you. But what it did, oh, my gosh, what it gave people the ability to do with the outside world when the regime was trying to shut it down. So I have to say I apologize for all the bad things I've ever said about Twitter. I'm still not going to Twitter, but I have to say I think that it's a form of communication that can be very powerful. So language, here's the question, are you a hope giver? Are you giving hope? Values. Forging community. When we look at values, one of the most important things you can do as a leader is ask a question and keep your mouth shut so you find out what other people value. That's how you build community. You don't even have to agree. And as we've heard over the last couple years and through the election, some people are probably sick of hearing it, but it is true because I've seen it around the world. I've personally experienced. We all have more in common around the world than we do in difference. We have so much in common. And as a leader, if you can ask a good question and then be quiet and listen, you will find out what people value. And then that, whether you like it or not, whether you agree with it or not, that isn't the point. The point is when you find out what people value, what organizations value, what countries value, you can then look at your own leadership style and say, now, how can I talk with this person, these people, this group that can bring us together in our shared values rather than driving a wedge between before I even get to open my mouth? So that values issue is very closely tied to communications. By the way, when I look at the various ones that are down there for you, I created a jigsaw puzzle, and each quality is a piece in the puzzle. You take one piece out, the puzzle falls apart because they are all dependent upon one another. They are not separate qualities. One builds on the other and is dependent upon the others. So when it comes to the values, what you want to do is you want to ask yourself, do I understand my followers' values? Maybe you don't. Maybe you do. Maybe you're not sure. And you can ask questions about projects they're working about. You can even come right out and say, what value do you put on this? Your name is what?
Carolee.
Carolee. You know, I can even come right out and say, Carolee, what value were you expecting when you came here tonight? What'd you come? What value did you want to take away? Good answer. I hope you do. She said to get something to learn. Yes, of course. That's what it was billed at. Tom and I talked about that, of what we should put on there. But that's not different than other people here in the room. How many others? Just show of hands. Wanted to maybe learn something new tonight, so... See? Look. Okay? Shared values. Shared values. All right. Now, perspective. It is Roman proverb says that if you forget exactly how it goes, one who forgets to learn from the past will remain forever a child, or very close to that. It's a Roman proverb. It goes back a long time. So when we look at perspective, what we want to do is we want to say, how do we take the best of the past, view the past, put it together with what's going on now, and try to find a way to get to the future? Now, I would like to give you very quickly, I wrote this down. I got to look at here, page 248. Billy, turn to 248 for me, will you? On the other side of your paper somewhere, I want to give you five books that I think are the best books that can help you have the best perspective you need to be a leader today in this era right now. And let me just give you the titles, and you go get them. One is, number one, called The Hidden Persuaders, written in 1957 by Vance Packard. There is a new edition. Forget it. Go to Amazon and get the original. It is incredible, because he wrote the instrument, the book, on how we are persuaded, manipulated through commercials and advertising and even political issues. And when you understand that you're being sold, manipulated, whatever, it changes it. Now you're smarter. You can make better decisions. Vance Packard's The Hidden Persuaders, one of the best books I've ever read. I still have it, and I wouldn't buy the updated version because he didn't write it. Sometimes leave well enough alone and just go with what really works. The other one, the second one is called The Seven Sisters, The Great Oil Companies and the World They Shaped. If you want to know why we're in the mess we're in right now and have been for the last 30 years, go on Amazon and get the book. And you'll read it and you'll say, oh, my. It is called The Seven Sisters, The Great Oil Companies and the World They Created. It's fascinating. It is as good as any Ludlum mystery. It is a page-turner. Don't read it before you go to bed because you won't go to sleep. Amazing book. Read it in its original form. There, people have written stuff. Get the original one. You can get it. I went on Amazon this afternoon just to be sure they have more copies. Number three, another oldie but goodie, written in 1982, called Corporate Cultures, The Rites and Rituals of Corporate Life. The best book still ever written on how corporations come together, how the DNA is constructed, how any organization works together, and the culture and what it means and how it changes or doesn't change. You know, trying to change GM is like trying to change a battleship, a carrier out in the middle of the ocean. It's very slow, as opposed to a little quick speedboat. Corporate Cultures. Next one, number four, is What the Great Religions Believe, written 1963. And you may say, do you like any current books? Yes, I do. I do. I've written about them. But these are the ones that give you the perspective. We're talking about perspective to know where we've been and where we are and where we're going. And so What the Great Religions Believe, I got to give you the author on this one because there's two or three that sound the same. His name is Joseph. I would expect you would say Gair, G-A-E-R. Sounds very Irish or Scottish. And then the last ones, which is my favorite, is my most dog-eared, precious book. I would never let anybody have it except that person sitting right there. But I don't have to because he's got his copy. It's called The Lessons of History by Will and Ariel Durant, D-U-R-A-N-T, written in 1968. Will and Ariel Durant are famous for their 12 volumes on civilization. They spent a lifetime writing it. Husband and wife team, Will and Ariel, A-R-I-E-L, Durant. They spent a lifetime writing the 12 volumes of civilization. They got to the end. They said, very few people except academics are going to read this. So then they wrote this little 193-page book that summarizes it all, and it's called The Lessons in History. When I go to universities and colleges and work with on the faculties and things, I have that as required reading. That must be part of the course so that the kids get a view of what the heck's been going on. So we look at perspective, and that's the books that I would suggest you read on that. And then power. I want to be sure to leave plenty of time for questions and answers, but let me give you one of the most powerful pieces of power that you can have. I have worked with four U.S. presidents. I've worked with governors, senators, congressmen, military leaders from Colin Powell down. Just about everybody. Hillary Clinton, Catherine Graham at the Post. So the point I want to say, though, is they all had a skill that is the most powerful piece of power, and that's their ability to listen. not just here where you talk and they're ready to spring with an answer or quick to say what they want to say. These people have the ability to listen to what you're saying. Bill's, come stand for a minute. Bill's tall, and there are several presidents that were also tall. Let me tell you what happens when you're talking to them. They will turn to you like this. They look you in the eye, and they are listening to what you are saying, and they give you so much of their attention. What actually happens, thank you, sweetheart, is they create a territorial imperative. They create an area into which other people will not come because it is very clear that they are talking to you like this. You know who pointed like that? Who always pointed? Which president? Clinton. Yes, Mr. President. Point back. But that's powerful. And regardless of your political affiliation, the people that are the most powerful leaders are those that can ask the question, engage people in conversation, and really listen. And you know how they're listening because they ask smart questions. They hear what you say, and then they ask a follow-up question. And if they like what you say, they ask another question. And by the way, you ever get a chance to talk to super, super powerful people, get it together, folks. Small talk is not in their game. I was with a very famous reporter one time, and boy, I mean, I walked in and stood there, and he said, so tell me, and there was something going on here in the San Francisco Bay Area. I live locally. And he said, so tell me about da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I went, whoa. Let me see, I have to think about that for a second. And he was very impatient. He said, well, and I answered, and I'm quite sure it was very unsatisfactory because I was not prepared for that. But most really great leaders are good listeners, and they will have questions for you. So when it comes to that power, this has nothing to do with what I just said, but it's, I write about it. The question under power is this. Why do you want it? Power is valuable. Power gets things done. Abusive power destroys everything it touches. Good power, well-used, wise juice, moves mountains, moves civilizations, can solve anything. So the question to ask yourself, whether it being a parent who has power over children, why do you want the power that you're seeking? And what will you do with it? And then the last course is number 8, and it's called Humility Matters. Go back to what I said in the beginning. A humble person understands that leadership is earned, not claimed. And some people foolishly think that loud, boisterous, arrogant, aggressive is strong. No, it's not. Arrogance is weakness. Arrogance is covering up a weak self-esteem or low self-image or inability to get the job done. So that arrogance and that hubris comes out. Humility is strong because someone who is humble, a humble leader, they're comfortable in their own skin. They know who they are. They know how to get things done. And if they don't, they go find somebody who does. That's the most powerful leader you can ever run into. Someone who says, I don't know how to do it. I'm going to go find someone who can give me the answers, or groups of people. So when we look at those qualities, again, I would just like to say that to top it all off, I've said it several times, leadership is earned. So when you look at people who call themselves leaders, say to yourself, did he or she earn my respect? Did they earn my loyalty? Did they connect with me? Do we even share any values? Or if we're very different, do they at least respect my values and give me credit for having my own values and what I believe in? To earn it, that's it. And they're the ones that are going to tell you whether you're a leader. And by the way, if you are a leader, you'll know it very quickly, because they will let you know. All right, so, Tom, we have some time for questions. All right, he's going to take this, and because I am vertically challenged, I'm going to stand on that little stool there, or that little thing that allows me to be seen over this very high podium.
Let's put our hands together for Sheila, please.
Thank you.
I want to remind our audience that we're listening to Sheila Murray Bethel, who's talking to us about matters of leadership and in fact, tonight's topic, it follows from her book, The New Breed of Leader, 8 Leadership Qualities That Matter Most in the Real World, What Works, What Doesn't, and Why. So as we move into Q&A, I would like to lead off, if I may. You made reference to a number of things like the seemingly increasing complexity of problems nowadays, and we hear a lot more in all organizations about the need of collaboration and teamwork and so forth. Not that teamwork's anything new, but it does lead me to wonder, and I'm so delighted when people come and have interest in this topic, which I've had a lifelong passion about, which is leadership. And I've seen over the years that people sometimes get hung up on the formalities or the structural things of positional leadership, if you will. And sometimes even our language about leaders and followers leads us to say to ourselves, well, gosh, I'm just a follower, so I guess I don't need to, you know, worry about this leadership stuff. And you certainly made reference early on that we all can learn our way into leadership. But I've seen over the years, too, that people who may not have any, let's say, people reporting to them, and you did mention also family and community efforts and so forth. So there's so many opportunities, it seems to me. And I wanted to have you, if you would, elaborate a little bit about how every person can take on these qualities of leadership and have the influence and so forth, and not just get all hung up on the positional aspects of being the quote-unquote leader. Would you just elaborate a little bit on that?
Sure. Everything I do is very descriptive and prescriptive. So, I'm basically a teacher in a suit. Not that teachers don't wear suits, but I go around lecturing and giving keynote addresses and consulting and things. And one of the things that I think we can do is we can build leadership. The interview guy today said, you know, can you build charisma? I said, well, I got to tell you, I don't think so. I mean, the old Broadway musical, you either got it or you ain't got it. I think charisma is something that few people have. But yes, you can build your leadership skills by understanding what are the skills needed today. And heaven's sakes, mine are not the only ones that are necessary. I mean, Barbara Kellerman just wrote a great book, Harvard PhD, on followers. I mean, you have all kinds of material out there. So you can build it by going and deciding which of the leadership qualities are important to you wherever you're trying to lead. As you said, Tom, in the family, in the community, a place of worship, in your job, wherever, volunteerism. And you can decide under competence, how am I going to get better at it? And you can go and find yourself a mentor. I have always had a mentor. The 25 years I've been in this business, and while my husband Bill is my partner, it isn't always someone that close to you. I've always had a mentor, someone that can lead you down the path to help you along the way. And you're never too old to have a mentor, ever. Because once you stop learning, you stop leading. So you can lead till you're 110. But if you have also someone that is a mentor you can bounce off of, because you need somebody to be able to bounce ideas off of and say, what do you think of this? And what do you think of that? And if they're, you know, trusted colleagues, they're not going to take a personal shot at you. They're just going to give you feedback. So I think we can learn by deciding what is important to us and then go find the information, build the competence so that you can become a leader when it is necessary. Maybe you don't even want to be a leader right now. But it's very funny how life and opportunity puts a leadership position right in our face sometimes, and we may not even be looking for it. And if you're prepared, you'll be able to take the reins. Question? Yes, sir.
I love your list of 8 qualities of leadership.
Thank you.
I think there's an interesting counterexample in the Bush-Cheney administration. I wonder if you could tell us your opinion of what might have happened to the country had they been followed these qualities and had them in the positive side.
Oh, I think that there was a lot of mistakes made because lack of competence. I think one of them we can look at it that it's just so easy to pick on. I almost feel bad because it's so easy to pick on. But it's Hurricane Katrina. I mean, it was just botched so badly. And I'm sure there are good people with good intentions, but they were not prepared. They were not competent. They did not know what to do, how to do it, ill-informed, didn't take responsibility, weren't accountable. Just that one example alone, how different would it have been had that been handled well instead of showing the whole world you know, total incompetence. I mean, that's just one example. So there are many things that we could, you know, take the past administration to task over, but that's not the point of what we're trying to do. But while I was writing it, these eight are why I wrote the book, because I saw them so lacking, not just in government, but in business too. I mean, you know, look at Enron. Oh, I don't want to say anything about someone who's passed away, but I mean, either Ken Lay was an idiot, and if he was, what was he doing as CEO of that company with all those millions of dollars, or he was totally incompetent? I mean, you know, it's one or the other. So I'm sorry, Mrs. Lay and your family, but come on, that was competence and accountability. Yes, another question.
Sheila, I yes. wanted to know if there are any attributes that you think are endemic to women in how they lead, similarities, differences, and maybe not, but I'm here with five other women in business.
Yes, I see that with your friends. People often say, well, you ought to build a women's leadership program. And my basic answer is there is no difference in leadership. It is not a female or male thing. But are there differences of how men and women function within that? Yes, of course there is. And one of the things that I find women leaders like Ursula Burns and Anne Mulcahy and Andrea Young, who I worked with many times, the CEO of Avon, Hillary Clinton, and Katharine Graham, of the former, you know, the late publisher of the Washington Post, and Ms. Clinton when she was first lady and as senator and all. Women seem to have their antenna out more on how people feel. Men have their antennas out on how to do it and how to fix it. I mean, a prime example, I will come into Bill and I will be frustrated about something, and really what I want is for him to listen, because I just want to vent, and he's got five answers for me on how to fix it. And that really is not what I was looking for. I wanted someone just to listen to my frustration. So I think women have the ability, not all women, because you can't, you know, we're not a block of just all thinking the same, but we do look at emotional things, and we may respond quicker, not necessarily better, but quicker to the emotional issues that leaders have to face. That's just one way I can think about it. Now, the best women leaders also have a great command of the language and know how to talk in words that immediately connect people, know how to use those words that bring people together, because they're really dealing from feelings first as opposed to how to. There's one expression I want to give you. The person that knows how to, there will always be a place for the person that knows how to. The person that knows why will inevitably be the leader in every situation in life that I've ever seen. And there's so much more, and I wish we had more time, and I'll be around afterwards if you would like me to expand upon that idea of women leadership. Yes, question.
Said that this
put the mic a little closer. There you go.
This is the age of questions.
Yes.
And I agree with that. I think good questions. I'm a coach, and I think
asking. You're a coach?
Yeah. I think asking good questions is really important, and sometimes
yes.
really hard. So on a more global level, so how come you think this age is particularly in terms of the age of questions as opposed to the 90s or the 80s or other?
Because we've never had such a confluence of the major worldwide issues all come together at the same time. Global warming, global economic breakdown, I mean, global poverty. I mean, so the major issues that we're facing are not just in this country or in Brazil or in London where I was recently. I mean, we have all come together. We are our brother's keeper. We are accountable for and to each other around the world. What happens in San Francisco matters in Buenos Aires. And what happens in Dubai matters in Provence, in France. So that's why I say that. This has never been a time. And the wisest leaders in the 21st century are going to be those people who are strategic enough to see the issues and find ways to blend their thinking with the issues that they're facing, and then go out with the good questions and find the people that will provide the answers. And how does their time and our time come together? Because the right people usually show up at the right time
to help solve the problems. And they aren't all presidents and CEOs, etc. There is some kid, 18, 19-year-old, sitting in a garage somewhere, going to come up with something that's going to solve our energy problems. And we had one called Gates. We had a couple called Jobs and Wozniak. There's somebody out there doing exactly the same thing to help all of our issues. That's why I say question, 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 more than ever before.
I want to remind our audience we're listening to Dr. Sheila Murray Bethel talking to us about a new breed of leader. And if I may, you made it pretty clear that your eight items were a puzzle and that it took all eight of them and it was highly interdependent and so forth and so on. But if you were pushed to say, gee, of these eight, this one or this one or two, you know, have a little slight nudge out in front. Have you got that? Do you think?
Bet.
Okay, please.
Humility. Do I have time for about a one-minute story?
Please.
The Washington Post company, newspaper and all, every year has an award for the best school principals in the tri-state area, D.C., Virginia, and Maryland. Thank you. And they put on this 3 days or 2 days of razzmatazz at the Mayflower Hotel in Washington, D.C. They bring these winning school principals in, and they wine and dine them the evening before, and fabulous. And then in the morning, they give an all-day program, and they have speakers. And so I was invited to, with my last book, it had just come out, and I was invited to be one of the keynote speakers on the next day. Went to the dinner the night before, and Ms. Graham, Catherine Graham at the time, had just written her autobiography, which was a Pulitzer Prize winner. And then First Lady Hillary Clinton had written It Takes a Village. And so we were the three speakers the next day. And so the next day, Ms. Graham spoke, incredible. What a person, what a human being. And Ms. Clinton spoke, and she left and went back to the White House. And at lunch, I was sitting next to Ms. Graham. And this is a woman who does not talk small talk. And I knew that. And I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to get to answer. I get one question. I better make it good. And I'm thinking, and I'm thinking. I said, so I turned to her. And she spoke with me, and she had known about the book that I'd written then, and she looked at it, and she had a copy, and so and I had hers, and so we were talking, and I said, Ms. Graham, you've known every great leader in the world for the last 50 years. Could you tell me what do you think is the most important leadership quality that we're going to need in this new century, millennium that we're coming into? She didn't bat an eye. It didn't take 10 seconds. She looked at me and she said, the absence of arrogance. Now, I have been writing on leadership for 25 years, and I've talked about humility and the power of humility and what it means and what you can do to bring people together. I have never had anyone ever come close to that kind of laser beam focused clarity, the absence of arrogance. It changed my entire view of how I look at anyone who is in a leadership position. She shocked me, and I thanked her, and I appreciate it, and I wrote all about it in this one because it was such an eye-opener. When you look at people, not only are they humble, but ask yourself, do they have an absence of arrogance?
We'll take one more question from the audience.
Yes.
Thanks.
Yes.
Thanks for all the information that you shared tonight, and you had some good perspective from the past. I was looking to a similar question that you asked from the lady you were just talking about.
Ms. Graham,
what is your perspective about this age of internet and computers and social networking and where we are today? I mean, you said absence of arrogance was what she highlighted.
Yes.
But putting that in context of what happens with Facebook and Twitter and the rest of it, how do you deal
with that? I don't think the jury is out yet. I really did think that Twitter was just a really silly waste of time. And as I said, I have changed my mind. When you can help people, help a revolution, you help people express. So there is, as everybody that anybody ever asked that question to, there's always the good, there's the bad. There's the predators on the internet, and there's the good that can come from spreading the knowledge. I think the biggest thing, the biggest benefit that we have from technology and the internet in this century that we are now living is that no one can hide and repress people anymore. the kids that know how to break the codes. In case you don't know it, there's a whole group. There's about 50 people around the world. And I learned about this on a very in-depth conversation about the internet. They have learned how to get past the blocks that the Iranian government put on all internet and that the Chinese put on to block so people can't get in and out. They're breaking those codes every single day. And there's only 50 people in the world, and they have a very special name, and I can't remember what it is. But these are the people that are going to open the world to everybody. That's the biggest benefit, is that you can't hide anymore. Everything you do is under a microscope as a leader, as a nation, as people, and that is the best thing that's going to happen. And at the same time, we're going to have to handle and find ways to somehow keep our children safe from the bad side of the internet. And that's going to take people a lot smarter than me to know how to do that. But I think we're going to be able to do that. I think we're going to find ways without trampling on civil rights or free speech or any of those things, because I'm concerned about Bill and I. We have 13 and a half grandchildren, and we want to be sure that they get the best what the internet has to offer and protect them from the bad that's there.
So, Sheila, as we go home this evening and contemplate this vital topic of leadership, what thought or two would you like to leave with us as we go?
I think that whether you're interested in becoming a leader or not, if you get involved in finding out about what good leadership means, it will make you a smarter follower. It will make you a better citizen. It makes you a better parent, a better person. Because the more we understand about what it takes to be a leader, the less likely we are to get the wool pulled over our eyes by smart people who know how to market, like Vance Packard talked about in The Silent Persuaders, that you'll be able to make better judgments. You'll be able to ask smarter questions. Leadership is important to everyone, whether you want to be a leader or not, because our lives depend on what kind of leaders we put into positions of power in this country and around the world. Thank you, Tom.
Let's put our hands together again for Sheila, please.
Thank you.
So I very much want to thank Dr. Sheila Murray Bethel for her tremendous insights tonight. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating over 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you all for coming.